Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 41. It's June 25th, 2020. It is the great triumph of compulsory government monopoly mass schooling that among even the best of my fellow teachers and among even the best of my students' parents, only a small number can imagine a different way to do things. The kids have to know how to read and write, don't they? They have to know how to add and subtract, don't they? They have to learn to follow orders if they ever expect to keep a job. Only a few lifetimes ago, things were very different in the United States. Originality and variety were common currency. Our freedom from regimentation made us the miracle of the world. Social class boundaries were relatively easy to cross. Our citizenry was marvelously confident, inventive, and able to do much for themselves independently and to think for themselves. We were something special. We Americans, all by ourselves, without government sticking its nose into and measuring every aspect of our lives, without institutions and social agencies telling us how to think and feel. We were something special as individuals, as Americans. But we've had a society essentially under central control in the United States since just after the Civil War. And such a society requires compulsory schooling, government monopoly schooling, to maintain itself. Before this development, schooling wasn't very important anywhere. We had it, but not too much of it, and only as much as an individual wanted. People learned to read, write, and do arithmetic just fine anyway. There are some studies that suggest literacy at the time of the American Revolution, at least for non-slaves on the Eastern Seaboard, was close to total. Thomas Paine's Common Sense sold 600,000 copies to a population of 3 million, of whom 20% were slaves and 50% indentured servants. Were the colonists geniuses? No, the truth is that reading, writing, and arithmetic only take about 100 hours to transmit, as long as the audience is eager and willing to learn. The trick is to wait until someone asks, and then to move fast while the mood is on. Millions of people teach themselves these things. It really isn't very hard. Pick up a fifth grade math or rhetoric textbook from 1850, and you'll see that the texts were pitched then on what would today be considered college level. The continuing cry for basic skills practice is a smokescreen behind which schools preempt the time of children for 12 years and teach them the seven lessons I've just described to you. The society that has come increasingly under central control since just before the Civil War shows itself in the lives we lead, the clothes we wear, the food we eat, and the green highway signs we drive by from coast to coast, all of which are the products of this control. So too, I think, are the epidemics of drugs, suicide, divorce, violence, and cruelty, as well as the hardening of class into caste in the United States, products of the dehumanization of our lives, of the lessening of the individual, family, and community importance, a diminishment that proceeds from central control. Inevitably, large compulsory institutions want more and more until there isn't any more to give. School takes our children away from any possibility of an active role in community life. In fact, it destroys communities by relegating the training of children to the hands of certified experts. And by doing so, it ensures our children cannot grow up fully human. Aristotle taught that without a fully active role in community life, one could not hope to become a healthy human being. Surely he was right. Look around you the next time you are near a school or an old people's reservation if you wish a demonstration. School, as it was built, is an essential support system for a model of social engineering that condemns most people to be subordinate stones in a pyramid that narrows as it ascends to a terminal of control. School is an artifice that makes such pyramidal social order seem inevitable, even though such a premise is a fundamental betrayal of the American Revolution. from colonial days through the period of the Republic, we had no schools to speak of. Read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography for an example of a man who had no time to waste in school. And yet the promise of democracy was beginning to be realized. We turned our backs on this promise by bringing to life the ancient pharaonic dream of Egypt, compulsory subordination for all. That was the secret Plato reluctantly transmitted in the Republic when Glaucon and Adcamantus, Glaucon and Adcamantus, possibly, extort from Socrates the plan for total state control of human life, a plan necessary to maintain a society where some people take more than their share. I will show you, says Socrates, how to bring about such a feverish city, but you will not like what I'm going to say. And so the blueprint of the seven-lesson school was first sketched. The current debate about whether we should have a national curriculum is phony. We already have a national curriculum locked up in the seven lessons I have just outlined. Such a curriculum produces physical, moral, and intellectual paralysis, and no curriculum of content will be sufficient to reverse its hideous effects. What is currently under discussion in our national hysteria about failing academic performance misses the point. Schools teach exactly what they are intended to teach, and they do it well. How to be a good Egyptian and remain in your place in the pyramid. None of this is inevitable. None of it is impossible to overthrow. We do have choices in how we bring up young people. There is no one right way. If we broke through the power of the pyramidal illusion, we would see that. There is no life and death international competition threatening our national existence. Difficult as that idea is even to think about, let alone believe, in the face of a continual media barrage of myth to the contrary. In every important material respect, our nation is self-sufficient, including in energy. I realize that the idea runs counter to the most fashionable thinking of political economists, but the, quote, profound transformation of our economy these people talk about is neither inevitable nor irreversible. Global economics does not speak to the public need for meaningful work, affordable housing, fulfilling education, adequate medical care, a clean environment, honest and accountable government, social and cultural renewal, or simple justice. All global ambitions are based on a definition of productivity and the good life, so alienated from common human reality that I am convinced it is wrong, and that most people would agree with me if they could perceive an alternative. We might be able to see that if we regained a hold on a philosophy that locates meaning where meaning is genuinely to be found, in families, in friends, in the passage of seasons, in nature, in simple ceremonies and rituals, in curiosity, generosity, compassion, and service to others, in a decent independence and privacy, in all the free and inexpensive things out of which real families, real friends, and real communities are built. Then we would be so self-sufficient, we would not even need the material sufficiency which our global experts are so insistent we be concerned about. How did these awful places, these schools, come about? Well, casual schooling has been with us in a variety of forms, a mildly useful adjunct to growing up. But modern schooling, as we know it, is a byproduct of the two Red Scares of 1848 and 1919, when powerful interests feared a revolution among our own industrial poor. Partly, too, total schooling came about because old-line, quote, American families were appalled by the native cultures of Celtic, Slavic, and Latin immigrants of the 1840s and felt repugnance toward the Catholic religion they brought with them. Certainly, a third contributing factor in creating a jail for children called school must have been the consternation which these same, quote, Americans regarded the movement of African Americans through society in the wake of the Civil War. Look again at the seven lessons of school teaching: confusion, class position, indifference, emotional and intellectual dependency, conditional self-esteem, and surveillance. All of these lessons are prime training for permanent underclasses, people deprived forever of finding the center of their own special genius. And over time, this training has shaken loose from its original purpose, to regulate the poor. For since the 1920s, the growth of the school bureaucracy, as well as the less visible growth of a horde of industries that profit from schooling exactly as it is, has enlarged this institution's original grasp to the point that it now seizes the sons and daughters of the middle classes as well. Is it any wonder Socrates was outraged at the accusation he took money to teach? Even then, philosophers saw clearly the inevitable direction the professionalization of teaching would take, that of preempting the teaching function which, in a healthy community, belongs to everyone. With lessons like the ones I teach day after day, it should be little wonder we have a real national crisis, the nature of which is very different from that proclaimed by the national media. Young people are indifferent to the adult world and to the future, indifferent to almost everything except the diversion of toys and violence. Rich or poor, school children who face the 21st century cannot concentrate on anything for very long. They have a poor sense of time past and time to come. They are mistrustful of intimacy, like the children of divorce they really are, for we have divorced them from significant parental attention. They hate solitude, are cruel, materialistic, dependent, passive, violent, timid in the face of the unexpected, addicted to distraction. All the peripheral tendencies of childhood are nourished and magnified to a grotesque extent by schooling, which, through its hidden curriculum, prevents effective personality development. Indeed, without exploiting the fearfulness, selfishness, and inexperience of children, our schools could not survive at all, nor could I, as a certified teacher. No common school that actually dared to teach the use of critical thinking tools, like the dialectic, the heuristic, or other devices that free minds should employ, would last very long before being torn to pieces. In our secular society, school has become the replacement for church, and like church, it requires that its teachings must be taken on faith. It is time that we squarely face the fact that institutional school teaching is destructive to children. Nobody survives the seven-lesson curriculum completely unscathed, not even the instructors. The method is deeply and profoundly anti-educational. No tinkering will fix it. In one of the great ironies of human affairs, the massive rethinking the schools require would cost so much less than we are spending now that powerful interests cannot afford to let it happen. You must understand that first and foremost, the business I'm in is a jobs project and an agency for letting contracts. We cannot afford to save money by reducing the scope of our operation or by diversifying the product we offer, even to help children grow upright. That is the iron law of institutional schooling. It is a business, subject neither to normal accounting procedures nor to the rational scalpel of competition. Some form of free market system in public school is the likeliest place to look for answers. A free market where family schools and small entrepreneurial schools and religious schools and craft schools and farm schools exist in profusion to compete with government education. I'm trying to describe a free market in schooling exactly like the one the country had until the Civil War, one in which students volunteer for the kind of education that suits them, even if that means self-education. It didn't hurt Ben Franklin that I can see. These options exist now in miniature, wonderful survivals of a strong and vigorous past, but they are available only to the resourceful, the courageous, the lucky, or the rich. The near impossibility of one of these better roads opening for the shattered families of the poor or for the bewildered host camped on the fringes of the urban middle class suggests that the disaster of seven lesson schools is going to grow unless we do something bold and decisive with the mess of government monopoly schooling. After an adult lifetime spent teaching school, I believe the method of math schooling is its only real content. Don't be fooled into thinking that good curriculum or good equipment or good teachers are the critical determinants of your son's or daughter's education. All the pathologies we've considered come about in large measure because the lessons of school prevent children from keeping important appointments with themselves and with their families to learn lessons in self-motivation, perseverance, self-reliance, courage, dignity, and love. And lessons in service to others, too, which are among the key lessons of home and community life. 30 years ago, these lessons could still be learned in the time left after school. But television has eaten up most of that time, and a combination of television and the stresses peculiar to two-income or single-parent families has swallowed up most of what used to be family time as well. Our kids have no time left to grow up fully human, and only thin soil wastelands to do it in. A future is rushing down upon our culture that will insist that all of us learn the wisdom of non-material experience. A future that will demand as the price of survival that we follow a path of natural life that is economical in material cost. These lessons cannot be learned in schools as they are. School is a 12-year jail sentence where bad habits are the only curriculum truly learned. I teach school and win awards doing it. I should know. And thus concludes John Taylor Gatto's The Seven Lessons of a School Teacher. I just looked a second ago. This is regular Dispatch 41. The simple show notes, a few links will be at regular.fm/41. I believe I also read portions of this speech, which he delivered in 1991 while being honored as New York State Teacher of the Year. I believe I also read from this source also on dispatches 11, 18, 20, and 32. Keep going back to Mr. Gatto, and I expect I will go back to other of his writings and speeches at some point in the future. It would be interesting for me to know. I can imagine that if for those of you who are listening along the whole time, like these ideas, maybe you identified immediately where it came from, the seven lessons. He references the seven lessons, you know, as, when I was a few minutes in, so that might have been a giveaway. But also I imagine that I'm hoping that the themes and his points were incredibly congruent with other readings from Frederick Douglass, Wendell Berry, Julian Simon, and more. They're of a piece. It's fascinating. It's just really fascinating to me to be going through this stuff in this little tiny medium with you. And I'm not certain of all of his allegations and conclusions. I find it reasonably persuasive. It also is a little startling to me that just public schooling and the manner that in which it is done, and it truly is a government monopoly that continues to just grow bureaucratically and expensively. To me, in my mind, often that's just considered as a given, a fixed state of affairs, and the way that it's done from fall through the spring, class bells ring, grades, sitting in a room with people of your age, all of those variables seem as a given, as the only way to do it. It's just sort of assumed, taken for granted, unchangeable. I don't know enough about the history also to assess the accuracy of his statements about this model of schooling being an official response to Red Scares in 1848 and 1919, to immigrant populations trying to hold control over them, to fears about the African-American population finally allowed to enter society, then, of course, being controlled through Jim Crow and just a dizzying, punishing layer upon layer of rules and regulations and such, that sort of defines the origin and purpose of this system, and that it has overwhelmed also the quote middle classes, the just communities everywhere. And that's an interesting idea, and his idea too, that it just crowds out all time and robs family time and community time. Certainly hear a lot these days about the burden of homework, in addition to just all that time in a school building, all the homework that's involved. It stands in stark contrast to things like the Acton School, started here in Austin and is growing like wildfire, though he does mention that these alternatives are available to the lucky and the rich, basically. And so it's a private school. It's expensive. They're trying to make it much more affordable than other private schools. And I will probably share some about the Acton approach in more detail at some point. I'll put some interesting stuff about them into the show notes. Laura Sandifer wrote a book. She started it with her husband, Jeff Sandifer. He's got some speeches at like South by Southwest and other places that are quite good, telling their story. Laura's book, Courage to Grow, is fascinating. It's fascinating as a parent. It's fascinating thinking back on my own trip through public schools. I have to say I was blessed and fortunate with quite a few truly exceptional teachers along the way. Nonetheless, I look at things like Acton and see the differences, and I can imagine, I certainly see the appeal for myself if I could have had that option when I were younger. At Acton, the students, they start in the first grade. You essentially need to learn how to read when you get there, at least enough to be self-directed, because you're in charge as the student. The student is in charge. They don't have teachers in the conventional sense. They call them guides. The guides do help, but it's a one-room schoolhouse approach. What that means is there are, I think it's up to, say, 30, 40 elementary-age kids all together from first grade through fifth grade. Then the same number of middle school kids all together, the same number of high school kids all together. And when they have more interested kids, they have to have a completely new campus. And it's growing like wildfire globally. People are able now to start their own Acton schools and join the system and hook into all the lessons and things. And so the kids, they spend their time in the morning generally doing core skills, the classic sort of reading, writing, arithmetic stuff, with Khan Academy and other such tools mainlined in the quote classroom. And I believe on Monday, children sit in small groups of two or four based on your age, and they all agree. They set their own goals for the week and share their goals for the week with their accountability partners. And then they're off. And if you want to do math all morning on Monday or read or all kinds of different things, you're in control of that time. Then they have lunch, and in the afternoon they do team-based projects. They're applying what they're learning as they go, and they just come up with all these different things from all kinds of topics and subjects to apply various lessons and work in teams, people slightly different ages. It's really, really cool. You earn sort of badges for skills and things that you prove out. I think the Sandifers would say that, you know, they borrowed from Alcoholics Anonymous and sort of a sponsor and the accountability and, you know, there's the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sort of, there's definitely an approach. Each group, the elementary, middle, and high school kids, that each year they update a contract, their agreements among themselves, how they're going to hold each other accountable, and it gets printed or written up on a poster, and everybody signs it and hangs on the wall. And so you set your goals on Monday, core skills in the morning, projects in the afternoon, and they put on these exhibitions. They come up with portfolios showcasing their skills, and they have these exhibitions on a rolling basis, I guess every 6 weeks or so, something like that. And so the kids are accumulating these portfolios. And as you get older, once you get into high school age, certainly by then, sort of apprenticeships and internships are built into school time. You are instructed to think about where you might want to go, what kind of calling you might have. You want to, you know, try a veterinary clinic or an ad agency or, you know, a podcaster, a radio, all over the place, a doctor's office. And these high school kids identify places they think they might like to apprentice, and they contact these places, and they secure internships. So we went to an open house there once, and I ran into somebody I knew in town, didn't realize his children went there, and they had three kids in the program. And his daughter, I think, was a junior, and she'd already put in months at a advertising agency, a vet, and some other place. And so they're getting real world experience early while learning. And they have, it's all Socratic all the time. So they have all these really cool Socratic discussions, student led, student, you know, peer to peer sort of led. And at the open house, which was all run by the students, it was all hands off from the adults, the students ran the whole thing. There was a Q&A, and one of the parents asked for an example of like what a Socratic discussion might be. And they had been reading Karl Marx and Milton Friedman and all this kind of economic literature. And one student shared that they had spent a couple hours that week in the afternoon. And the question up for debate was, if you could only keep one, political freedom or economic freedom, which would you keep and why? And so they just had this free-ranging discussion about all that, applying the things they were reading about and learning. So it was fascinating. And I don't think there's much in the way of homework. Like when you leave school in the afternoon, you're done. In one sense, there's not a whole lot of grades. I read the Laura Sandifer's book, Courage to Grow, where she kind of tells their personal story for why they started it and how it's grown. And towards the end, they had an event during South by Southwest, the EDU conference that precedes the big internet movie film, thing gathering just the week before. There's EDU, and they had a couple of hundred people come over to the main campus that they have in East Austin, and it's kind of in between Manor and MLK, and hosted an event, and they had some of the owners of other Acton academies here in Austin and in other countries representing and for the Q&A. And I believe the question was, you know, what is one of the things that really surprised you about running a Acton Academy? And someone from, I don't remember what country she was from Latin America. She though mentioned that in one sense they were, you know, about grades. She was commenting about grades, and she said, it's true. In one sense, they don't have grades, but in another sense, everybody gets 100. You don't get to advance to the next thing until you've proven mastery over that topic. So imagine Khan Academy or Duolingo or some online learning type tool that you might use yourself. And what that really showed too is that, like, they're very willing, like, you fail, you fail, you fail, you don't get it until you get it, you keep working on it. But they don't hold the practice rounds against you, as it were. Not everything is this perilous trip on grades. And, you know, in this state now, you've got to graduate, I think, in the top 6% of your class to be eligible to get into UT, or at least based on your class rank and such. I don't know the current status on how SAT and PSAT and all that standardized testing stuff plays into getting in. So I think it's fascinating. There is a whole bunch of families that are now participating in this model. It started with when Jeff and Laura literally wanted a better model for their own children. Those children are now reaching college age, which means a lot of the early, their kind of first campus, and a lot of the other campuses are now having high schoolers. So I have to say, I can't wait to see what effect this has, this population is going to have. And there's other models. There's many other private schools and different kinds of models like this. They're all mixing and matching many of the same influences. And I think John Taylor Gatto in this book is one of a whole sea of influences on this kind of thinking. And so I'm going to be fascinated to see what happens to this assumption that just a given you're going to go to college for 4 years. And in the last couple of decades, you just assume it's going to cost a fortune to get that done. And you might even finish with a mountain of debt. What formerly would have been your first house is now locked up in college. So I'm just going to be fascinated to see how it plays out. And I'm going to try to read more about this stuff. The whole idea of education and learning is a fascinating one. And none of us ever stop for our own, with our own minds, of learning and growing. And often we have children or nephews and nieces, family or children of friends. It's a topic, of course, that we all have a vested interest in. And I think John Taylor Gatto provides another warning that it's important really to see what is this system teaching? What is it actually built to do? And there's a bit of a warning in there, because if he's right, then what it's teaching are not good lessons for citizens, for humans. It's rough. It's rough. It is not the kind of stuff we want to be imprinting on people. It's contrary to many of our ideals. I read a couple of days, I think, from Louis L'Amour's Education of Wandering Man. He left school at 15 and traveled the world working, and has really fascinating stories about being a hobo and what that meant at the time. A laborer that traveled about where work is needed. And it turns out that there was this whole network of books, little blue books, I think they were called, that were traded among hobos. And he just read and read and read and tried to acquire as much education as he possibly could, as much learning as he possibly could, without school at all. He says he values school, and some of his best friends are teachers and educators and values all of that stuff. But it just goes to show that for all of us, to the extent that we assume something like that is fixed and unchangeable, a given, maybe it's not. And maybe with all that's happening now, social issues, COVID, work from home, virtual schooling, one way I've heard that phrased just from a friend is 10 years of change will happen in 10 months. Well, maybe we can look at some of these variables and decide if we should at least have some variety and some experiments out there that may be more than one right way centrally controlled is worth trying. With the idea that not every child is the same, not every discipline and domain is the same, not every situation is the same, we don't all learn the same way, and see what happens. I'm pleased that there are people like the Sandifers and many others trying to start other school approaches. And to the extent that those kinds of things work, if we can find a way to make those options available to more people in the spirit of access to opportunities and learning, and as in an earlier dispatch, Lech Walesa would say, the normal things of life, and as Vaclav Havel in Czechoslovakia, also under the Soviet bloc, also had a lot to say about just the normal stuff of life, growing up and learning, that maybe what we can do is try a whole lot of new approaches. It would be very refreshing, and in the spirit of Julian Simon, we all benefit if more people can learn and apply themselves and engage in this marketplace. There are very serious problems. Those problems have solutions. Some of those solutions we haven't figured out yet, but it's only other people that are going to figure out those solutions. And we need a lot more experiments across the board. And by the way, there's often a good money to be made in fixing problems and helping people grow. And that would be wonderful too. At all levels in this society, we've got a lot of debts. And to work our way out from those debts is going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of rising economic tides. So here's hoping we figure it out. And per Wendell Berry and Think Little and his comments that I read yesterday, it's a lot of little local problems. Nobody's going to get famous. But each person has a huge, huge role to play. Thanks, y'all.